Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the line is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're having a good day.
I hope you are, too, and staying inside if you're in Iowa, which is where two of the three people today, I believe, are in Iowa. Caroline is. Our guest.
I am also in Iowa, ready to drive north to Minnesota as soon as I get done.
And I'm actually in Austin, Texas today. So we will be talking about both of those places during our interview today.
Great.
Caroline, who do we have with us?
Well, today we have a most interesting book. It's called, the title is Slippery Steps, Rolling and Tumbling Toward Sobriety. And the author is Don McLeese. And he is a professor at the University of Iowa. And a little bit about his background. Before joining the journalism faculty of the University of Iowa, he was a popular music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times and the Austin American Statesman, senior editor at No Depression, and a frequent contributor to Rolling Stone. His work has also appeared in publications including the New York Times Book Review, the Oxford American and Entertainment Weekly. He has written three previous books, including Dwight Yoakam, 1,000 Miles from Nowhere, which sounds interesting, too. This book is very interesting. In fact, it's a must-read. It's a must-read. I'll put it that way. Okay.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Don.
Thank you for having me.
So your other books are not memoirs.
No.
This is your first memoir. What made you decide to write your life story?
Well, there, you know, to unpack that question, we could probably take the whole hour. But part of it's simply professional. You know, as a university professor, part of my job description is to continue to be a productive working journalist. And, you know, to publish things that will connect with readers. I thought I had a story here. I thought I'd be more interested in spending a few years on this than on some other project. So there was professional motivation to do this as part of my job. I also considered it in some ways part of my recovery, which, you know, stresses opening the windows, cleaning house. There's an old 12-step adage, and 12-step programs are filled with adages, but one of them is, you are only as sick as your secrets. And so this book was a way of exposing, you know, just illuminating all that. And probably the best reason, and the reason that that kept me going through all this, is I really wrote it for myself. I was trying to explain myself to myself, how I had gotten to this particular point in my life, what I had gone through, and trying to connect some dots, fill in some blanks, make some sense, you know, between various stages of my life, that some of which no longer really even seemed like the same person. When I was writing this, you know, I almost had to write it as if nobody would be reading it, that I was just, you know, nobody would be trying to market it or whatever. It would simply be, you know, me writing the most honest book I could.
And when you were done and you realized you were going to publish it, was that scary that you had put so much of yourself on the page?
Not really scary. During the end of my time at the Austin American Statesman, I had moved from being the pop music critic to being their lead general interest columnist. And I got to write about everything there. And I often drew from personal experience in writing those columns. So So I was familiar with, you know, writing about myself and my family, developing a voice that that might have some self-deprecating humor, trying not to take myself too seriously. It's like I had lived with this book for 6 or 7 years, and we'd gone through COVID, which, you know, changed everything and delayed everything, the whole process. Became much more difficult than I had anticipated to get this book out. So by the time I was ready to have it published, what I felt more than anything else was relief rather than fear. You know, it's like I've been living with this for all this time. Now you can live with it for a while.
Well, so the focus of the book, of course, is obvious from the title, Slippery Steps, Rolling and Tumbling Towards Sobriety. And that is that you were a heavy drinker and how that impacted your life at various stages while you were in denial that it was ever a problem.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And by heavy drinker, I was a daily drinker. There are all sorts of different types of alcoholics. And if you're trying to convince yourself that you are not an alcoholic, you can just point to, you know, I didn't get, you know, I
I'm not like them.
Yeah, I'm not like them. Yeah. And that's what most, you know, recovery books are like. It's like, boy, I'm glad I don't have that person's problems. But I drank daily. I was drinking progressively more. I was drinking in what now seems to me a really unhealthy fashion. I was drinking more. I was drinking alone. I was in my room. I was hiding it. I had gone from being a social drinker to what I called an antisocial drinker. And I was just, you know, numbing myself. Part of what I wanted to address in this book is how what we might consider normal drinking, whatever normal drinking is, how that can progress to something that is more problematic, even if the person within whom it is progressing doesn't consider it a problem at the time.
Yeah.
You know, what surprises me is that the heavy drinking did not apparently impact your general health that much. I mean, there, you know, sometimes people, it really messes up their health, but it didn't seem to happen to you. So you must be very fortunate there.
Well, yes, I believe I am. And I also, you know, this was part of the elaborate and complicated chemistry experiment that is my life. But I always thought that I was balancing whatever bad things I was doing to myself with good things I was doing for myself. I mean, I've always exercised. So it was, you know, I'm productive. I work hard. So it was like, I'm doing all these things that are good for me. So I should, you know, if I work hard, I should be able to play hard. There wasn't much of a sense of play toward the end of my drinking, but I also, you know, I mean, to me, alcoholics were people who got the shakes, who kind of had to lurch for that first drink early in the morning. I never drank or rarely drank until dinner and afterwards. But then once I'd started, I just didn't stop.
And also, so a lot of your career was spent as a rock critic, going to listen to rock bands in bars and places
in
where
bars.
Drinking
yeah.
is just a really important part of the culture.
Not only part of the rock culture, which in some ways, and I don't mean this as a criticism at all, but it's perpetual adolescence. It's denial of growing up. You can live in that world and, you know, think of Mick Jagger entering his 80s or whatever as this sort of, you know, Peter Pan. And rock is, sex and drugs and rock and roll and too much ain't enough and all that. It glorifies that. It glorifies that mm-hmm. sense of reckless abandon. But I also worked within a profession which it isn't as much so now. I mean, nothing about journalism is like it used to be. But the way journalism used to be was it was also a profession that glorified that work hard, play hard. The hard-bitten, hard-drinking reporter.
Yes,
everybody
absolutely.
Had a bottle of booze.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a double whammy that I, and then, you know, I went from that to being a college professor on what is occasionally called the number one party school in the country.
Yes, I know. I'm
drinking capitals. And when you're, you know, when you're on a college campus, the kids never get any older because they're, you know, they just keep recycling. They're always
the
same age.
Yeah.
And you can kind of pretend to yourself that you're not getting any older. The fact is that I was getting older, you know, and I was drinking more and, you know, it was time to put away foolish things.
Well,
so that's what the book's about.
One of the reasons I think that I never drank very much, I really enjoy cocktails. I really enjoy wine, some beer, you know, but I never drank very much because there's too much calories in alcohol and I didn't want to get fat.
I don't know if
I was drinking the amount that you were, I mean, I couldn't have eaten anything because there would be no calories left from it.
Well, and that's true. And early on in my journalistic career, I would, you know, every Friday night I would do what I call drink dinner, you know, because I'd meet with some guys, you know, mainly guys, after the work week was over and we go to a bar. Yeah, with the idea of having a couple drinks before dinner, and by the time I was rolling out of there or sloshing out of there or whatever, 3 hours later, I had no appetite whatsoever, you know, and I just drove home drunk. Probably drove home drunk, you know, pretty
regularly.
Most nights of my life. I mean, that's, you know, I was very fortunate.
Yeah, you were.
Yes, you were.
I mean, that's the scariest thing about it, really, because one wrong turn, one delayed reaction, and you could have been spending your life in prison.
Oh, yes. And I've met plenty of people in AA who have spent considerable amounts of their life in prison. I've met them who, you know, have gotten into accidents, gotten DUIs, gone to prison, gone to AA, and then gone back out again and started drinking again and gotten another DUI or whatever. Yeah, I mean, people who have killed people. It's horrible, the toll that it takes. And again, I just feel very fortunate. You know, I mean, I never lost a job, never, you know, and never lost my freedom, never lost whatever was left of my sanity.
You know, Don, it's interesting in your book, you do credit AA to some extent with helping you achieve sobriety, but you're definitely not proselytizing for it because there's always a little bit of hesitation when you talk about it. Why is that?
I definitely credit AA with getting me sober and keeping me sober. And I credit my wife, above all, for getting me, you know, for convincing me that I had a problem and getting me to AA. Some people, you know, it's like if we compared AA to the religious landscape or even the Christian landscape, you know, it's, you know, there are fundamentalists in AA, and fundamentalists will be, you know, until you turn everything over to God, until, you know, you're just, giving up any sense of self-will of import, you know, whatever, you don't have a hope of staying sober. And one of the things I learned in AA is that AA is it can be a big tent. There are certain things about AA that I'm absolutely convinced it works. I'm absolutely convinced that I have witnessed what some people would call miracles in that program, of people who had thrown mm-hmm. away their lives and somehow ended up with a much better life than they could have ever anticipated. And that's including myself. But I'm not, you know, I'm not a conventionally religious person. I have a profound gratitude toward whatever got me to AA and kept me in AA. I believe in the concept of grace, because I don't think, you know, I think there's a lot of people who wanted this sobriety, you know, who were more determined than I was, and, you know, many of them are dead. They for whatever reason couldn't get and stay sober. So I give all credit to AA, but I'm not the AA equivalent of a Bible thumper. I'm not a big book thumper. You know, I was trying to tell a good story, and I know that a lot of the people who I have gotten sober with, are also people who aren't conventionally religious, who might even be agnostic, but they have come to recognize that they are connected to something bigger than themselves, that rather than being so inwardly focused, which means trying to control everything, trying to, you know, and that's, addiction is the ultimate, trying to control everything, trying to prevent anything from changing, you know, getting that high and keeping that high, you know, and that's impossible. I suspect that my version of 12 steps leans a lot more toward, you know, what some would consider Eastern philosophy. The only constant is change. And we have to get comfortable with the whole idea of letting go. And letting go is a big thing in AA. Quit trying to clutch, you know, whatever it is, that addiction, that feeling that you can feel like this forever. Instead, you know, get used to a certain amount of discomfort. You're going to be able to make it through these periods where you're not getting that drink that your mind's telling you need to have. Your mind is fooling you. I wouldn't say I'm ambivalent at all about AA. I've made really good friends within AA. I think that if anything, I'm more of a defender against other people who say, oh, you know, it's a cult, it's all about God, it's, you know, it's like the There, you have to, you know, in the book, I certainly, you know, had all those sort of, you know, feelings, you know, well, when do I have to take the blood oath and sell my first child and, you know, whatever it is. And I finally came around to believing that these people didn't want anything from me. They simply wanted me to get better and stay better. That they're, you know, mm-hmm. it was kind of the closest thing to unconditional love that I have ever felt from, you know, a bunch of strangers. And it opened me up to a lot of things.
Don, you said that the only constant is change. I'm curious if you have read Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower.
I have not.
Okay.
I probably should have read a lot about Octavia Butler. Because
kind of the theme of that book. There's a series of books. There's two, I think, two parables. Yeah. I can't remember what the other one is, but anyway.
Well, to my mind, that is kind of the theme of this universe and whatever lies beyond. You know, I mean, we're always moving. We're always changing. We're always dying. You know, I mean, all these things. And whatever you try to grasp onto, it's going to be gone.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Don McLeese, author of Slippery Steps, Rolling and Tumbling Toward Sobriety. So in your book, you talk about when you became a journalism professor, that you, you know, as many people know, in academia, there's this publisher perish paradigm. And so you have to start, you have to be writing books and in order to get tenure and so forth. And so are all the books that you've published, were, did they come from that time period or were some of them before that?
No, all of them were, I was under an unusual situation. I mean, and you know, one doesn't have to publish books in order to be tenured, but one has to publish, and there's kind of, you know, some very obscure metrics that, you know, you have to have so many, you know, it has to be, it all has to add up to something that they consider tenurable. Also, you know, what nobody had told me before I embarked on this tenure track path is that nothing that I had done, you know, all of this journalism that I had done for decades would count at all towards tenure. That everything for tenure, I mean, the reason I had hired is because, about what I was hired was because of what I had done, but none of that would count. I had to start from scratch. Plus, in order from their standpoint to make a competitive salary offer, they hired me at the level of associate professor, which is generally the title you get after you've gotten tenure. So it's like you're hired as an assistant professor. You know, you're kind of an apprentice, and then you've got 6 years or whatever it is to compile the dossier that you submit for your tenure. I was hired as an associate. I was given 3 years, so I was.
You're on the fast track.
I was on the fast track. I had to hit the ground running, and so yeah. I mean, my first book, a very slim book, but it was, you know, and it was all about rock and drugs and revolution and the 60s and all that kind of stuff. That was in large part what sealed my tenure case. And then everything since then has been, I mean, this book I may well have written even if I had not, you know, had an academic reason to do so. I mean, at this late stage of my career, they're not going to boot me out. Mm. But the other three books were all written because of the necessity to be a productive journalist while teaching journalism.
Now, you talk several times in the book about how journalism has changed, how, like, you couldn't have, it would be very hard for somebody starting today to have the career that you had.
It would be impossible.
And why is that?
Everything has shifted. The internet and digital technology have shifted that paradigm to the point where what were once paying jobs no longer pay. People are accustomed, you know, well, let's just take one example. What the kind of thing that, you know, I was valuable because through my writing, I could provide a consumer service in telling people what concerts to go to, what albums to buy, you know, that sort of thing. Same with movie reviewers. Now that you can stream everything, nobody is buying music, but the whole industry has shifted. The whole idea of having to pay to read somebody when everything is for free, so much of everything is for free on the internet, that career path no longer really exists in the way it once did. There are a handful of people doing it, but it's almost like they have been grandfathered or grandmothered in, you know, and there are new ways of trying to approach this. But yes, the old career path that, you know, that I was operating under, where for a brief time, every major metropolitan newspaper had a rock critic, a classical critic, a TV critic, a film critic, a drama critic. Now most newspapers have none of those. So yes, it's very, or you know, book sections and book review editors, you know, were a huge deal, and they've fallen by the wayside. And part of that is that those were dependent on print advertising, and the print advertising revenues, digital advertising, you know, is not as lucrative as print advertising was. So yeah, I mean, it's a whole other book, but that's, in a nutshell, everything has changed.
So but you're still teaching journalism at a university. What do you tell your students?
Well, I'm teaching, you know, some of my best students are actually going into what we would recognize as legacy journalism, traditional journalism. They're getting jobs at Iowa papers. They're working for the Des Moines Register or the Quad City Times or the Cedar Rapids Gazette or whatever. It's probably easier to get entry-level jobs and to move up that ladder a little bit in certain times of certain kinds of journalism than it ever was, or you know, in my day, because it used to be that there were, you know, destination papers that you would work your career to get to the point where you would land at one of those destination papers, and that was the pinnacle of your career. Now some of those destination papers are buying out all their oldest and most experienced and higher priced people. So it's like what was once the top of the ladder is now the middle of the ladder, and that ladder is to a diving board that when you jump off, you're not quite sure where you're going to land. So professionally, we can do better journalism than ever before. We have all the tools. We have the internet. We can track stuff down. We can extend the net for sources. We can provide visuals. We can provide audio. We can do it quickly. And there's also a huge hunger for all this, and particularly coming out of the Trump era, places like, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, CNN, all reaching exponentially more consumers than they ever did before. So people want this stuff. People need this stuff. We can provide it better than ever. But there is a total breakdown of the business model. You know, great, good journalism requires a financial subsidy. Where is that going to come from? Is it going to come from subscriptions? Is it going to come from, you know, I don't know, federal funding, you know, and then you get into a whole, you know, do you criticize the federal government that is funding your operation? You know, there's all this stuff. But on another level, I mean, what I teach in particular, entertainment journalism, arts journalism, features journalism, all this kind of storytelling, I teach them that this is a way of enriching your life, that this, you know, that whether they end up responding to the arts in print, as I did for a long time, or just through social media posts or engaging with other people, these conversations are what humanize us, that, you know, that the arts have an intrinsic value, and learning how to respond to the arts, developing and sharpening those instincts, that has an intrinsic value. And I really, you know, I decry the sort of education that puts a price tag on everything, you know, that if you study this, you're going to make this amount of dollars or whatever. I was an English major. I have a master's in English from the University of Chicago. And at the time that I got that was considered the most useless degree you could have. You know, what are you going to do as an English major? You know, and now some of these kids, their parents are telling them, why do you want to be a journalism major? Because they keep reading from journalists that journalism is a dying breed.
Yeah.
Journalism is a changing operation, and also the skills that one learns in journalism how to think clearly, how to write clearly, how to focus and frame an argument, how to build a case. These are things that that are required in pretty much any communications industry. And I have some great pre-law students. You know, my brother's a criminal defense attorney, and he says that what he does and what I do are very similar as far as writing journal, that I'm presenting a narrative.
Right, absolutely.
The narrative. I'm trying to get the reader to see this through my eyes.
And I'll tell you, businesses of all kinds need writers. You know, my business, it's a manufacturing business, consumer products, and I'm always looking for writers for our packaging copy, for our sales materials, for our blogs, for our social media. And it's hard to find people who are reliable, can write well, and don't need heavy editing. It's hard to find them.
Well, you come to the University of Iowa, and
I will connect you with all sorts of people.
They come out of our program, and they're good to go.
All right. That's good to know. You know, Don, I did a little bit of music journalism in early, many years ago. I had a friend who was a concert promoter. He's now a very successful promoter in Las Vegas, but at the time he was in Fairfield, Iowa, and he was working on a shoestring budget, and I wrote the publicity for his concerts. So I did Buddy Guy, I did Richie Havens, I did Mac Gayden, and Roger McGuinn from the Byrds.
McGuinn, yes.
Yeah. So those were the four that I interviewed and wrote about. And you've probably have spoken to all of them.
I've spoken to many of them.
Yeah.
Roger McGuinn was from Chicago when he was Jim McGuinn and was at the Old Town, learned from the Old Town School of Folk Music, and, definitely has a... I've spoken to so many people that sometimes in my old age, it's hard for me to remember. Did I talk to them, or did I just read a lot about them?
I know that I talked to, I don't know if I actually talked to Buddy Guy. I might have just written it out of his press materials. But the others I remember speaking, doing one-on-one interviews with.
I talked with Buddy Guy on numerous occasions. Yeah. He's a very nice man.
Yeah. So, there's a lot in your book that, I'm a little bit younger than you, not a whole lot. And so there was a lot that felt familiar to me. And of course, I've lived in Iowa and Austin, two places where you've lived also. So
right.
we have a lot in common, Don.
Uh-huh. Well, one thing that I'm discovering through the book, I was assuming that it would have most interest and value for those who were in a similar position than I was, who were starting to ask themselves questions, am I drinking too much? Or, is the time going to come when I need to stop, or this or that? Nothing's fallen apart yet, but they can perhaps see it on the horizon. And my answer to that is, if you're asking yourself those questions, you probably are. Because normal drinkers don't really ask themselves those questions.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah, they kind of take it or leave it. But what I've discovered is that a lot of people come at this book from I did a book event in Chicago that attracted a lot of journalists and music fans and people that did not necessarily come looking for anything about their drinking, but just wanted to hear war stories about journalism and rock journalism and music and all that sort of thing. Other people, part of what I'm trying to do in the book, and I'm trying to do so many things in the book, But part of what I'm trying to do is show how dramatically societal cultural attitudes have changed. That now I kind of think of, some behavior as problem drinking that half a century ago wouldn't have been considered a problem at all. Like when I was growing up, it was just assumed that if you drank beer, you couldn't be an alcoholic. It was just, alcoholism was, brown bag, living under the bridge, hard liquor, rot gut liquor, all that sort of thing. And now I think we have some very different attitudes about a lot of different things. You used to be able to smoke on airplanes. The idea that you could smoke on airplanes, I think, people would think it's crazy.
It was crazy.
Yes. Well, you could smoke in restaurants, and there are restaurants, bars. And the idea that there was an uproar when they tried to get rid of that, that sort of thing. But people just had different attitudes. Yeah. So,
You talk about your dad drinking a 12-pack every night.
Yes.
Which to me is unfathomable.
Well, my dad seemed to handle his liquor great. And so many people in the 50s and the 60s, they drank so much. And that's one thing that other people have commented on, that, yeah, my parents were the same way. It was just so much a part of our lives. And now it's like we're thinking about this. Is there something wrong with my life that I have to numb myself every day? Do I have to distort my senses in order to have fun? What is it about, why do I require something outside of me to allow myself to feel okay about life as it is? Another one of those AA adages, living life on life's terms. You deal with it. You don't reach for a drink because you're on edge. You don't take a pill because you're having trouble sleeping. You kind of work your way through it, one day at a time. Which, to my mind, even though it's the basis of a Christian-based program, it's a very Eastern sort of concept. One breath at a time, one second at a time. It's all changing.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Don McLeese, author of Slippery Steps, Rolling and Tumbling Towards Sobriety.
What I found very interesting was the action inside AA. There's no shaming of any kind. Nobody's judging. Everybody's there to help everybody else. I thought that is really great. It really is. And no cross-talking. Can you explain that?
You're not there to give anybody else advice. You're certainly not there to pass judgment on anybody else. We think that we are better than, or that we are qualified to pass judgment on others. It's just more a helping hand and empathy. And I spent a lot of my life, I'm in the business of judging people. That's what I did as a music critic for decades, and that's what I do now as a professor, giving grades. So I'm temperamentally very well suited to my jobs, but within AA, you're encouraged to not judge people by how they dress, how they talk, what they've been through, to recognize that we're all there because we had some sort of drinking problem, some sort of living problem, and that the connection we make as part of the human condition, I really, and this is another tangent on my part, but I really think that as human beings, we are all in some way broken. We have this emptiness inside. I spent a lot of my time trying to, having that spiritual hunger, trying to fill that with alcohol, trying to fill that hole with alcohol, and not realizing that I was just digging the hole deeper. That every drink just contributed to filling that hole. And I think within AA, you've got all sorts of people in there who who recognize that, yes, this, you know, this is part of the human condition, that we're looking for something outside of ourselves to complete ourselves, to make ourselves whole, and just the sharing. But that's also one way, you know, that's one way I wanted this book to function, is that I think that, you know, until one goes to AA, until one, you know, it's anonymous. You're not supposed to talk about it. You know, you're not supposed to, it's a secret society or somewhat. And, you know, and so most people don't really know anything more about it than what I knew. 12 steps, didn't know what any of them were. Something to do with God, in whom I didn't believe, and you know what, and so this is kind of my way of taking somebody who was in the same position that I was and saying, you know, okay, it's okay. Let me bring you in. Let me show you what it's like. You can decide for yourself whether you want to hang around or not. Nobody's going to make you do anything or say anything or believe anything or whatever, but you know, you might find some answers here. Hmm. I did, you know, so that's
Don, before we run out of time, would you like to read a little bit from Slippery Steps?
I'd be happy to.
Great.
I will. For whatever reason, the opening of the book has drawn a lot of response, you know, in terms of the writing. So I will just read from the start of the book.
Perfect.
And this is kind of my drunk noir. so it's kind of dark and seamy and whatever, but what I have to tell you is that this book has a happy ending because I'm here talking to you about it, you know, and it's
that's a good point.
Yeah.
So everything turns out all right in the end. Okay. Chapter one. It was a drunk and stormy night. The flashlight shot through my stupor like a laser beam to the skull, sparking the first faint glimmers of consciousness. Above me, a male voice, with calm authority, asked, "Are you all right, sir?" His concern was impersonal. I could tell before opening my eyes that I didn't know him and that he didn't know me. He had been summoned in some official capacity. He was probably half my age. Was I all right? I suppose I was, still breathing, semi-conscious, feeling no pain. So I mumbled something in the affirmative, likely unintelligible. But I really had no conception of what all right might mean. I wasn't exactly sure who I was, where I was, or why. I had no idea how long I had been there. It was very dark out, and it was still pouring. But was it 10 at night or 4 in the morning? There was lightning and there was thunder. It was a hot August night in West Des Moines. I was lying on the grass, immobile, soaked. So the stranger's question made little sense to me, and neither did his presence. But the fact that he was talking to me, that he was there at all, suggested that something was very wrong and likely to get worse. Who was I? I was the guy who lived in the house that had this fenced backyard, which I had awakened to vaguely recognize. For some reason, I was on the ground, my predicament witnessed by someone I didn't know, someone who didn't belong here. Not that I belonged here, on the ground, in the downpour. As the fog in my head continued to clear, here's what I remembered. I had taken Rosie, our Cavalier King Charles puppy, out into the rain. She had been scared of the thunder and wouldn't go on her own. When I followed her down the soaked steps, I didn't feel like I'd had too much to drink. Almost a bottle of wine at dinner, then a cigar, followed by a full snifter or two of brandy. I know what drunk felt like, and I wasn't, or hadn't been. If I'd returned inside, I likely would have felt the need for another glass or a joint or both before I could fall asleep, or more accurately, pass out, as was my nightly ritual. But something had happened. When Rosie was done, quickly, she had run up the stairs to the deck and I had followed her, or attempted to. My legs wouldn't move the way my foggy brain had told them to. I had tried and failed repeatedly to navigate the three wooden steps that rose from our backyard to the deck outside the back door. I simply couldn't maintain my balance long enough or move my legs well enough to climb three slippery steps. Eventually, I decided on a different approach. I would crawl up the stairs on my hands and knees, figuring that a lower center of gravity might help. Actually intuiting. I wasn't thinking clearly or rationally. But I could no more crawl up those stairs than climb them. I'd make it up one and then slip back while trying to hoist myself, balancing on my forearms, up the second. In retrospect, I must have looked like a slapstick Sisyphus, but it was no laughing matter at the time. I was becoming increasingly desperate and wet. It was starting to rain even harder. I have no idea how long I kept trying, failing, and humiliating myself before I gave up. Felt like an hour or so, could have been 5 or 10 minutes. Long enough that my knees and elbows had bloody scrapes and that I would have visible scars on my arms for days afterward. It was late, hot summer, and I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt. At some point, as I lay semi-comatose, my wife Maria had come out and shrieked, "Donald, what are you doing?" The dog had come upstairs and I hadn't. But it wasn't just that. Most nights I stayed downstairs for a while after Maria and Rosie had both gone up. If I were to drink as much as I'd like, it was easier to do so without Maria monitoring me. And then I'd slip into bed after she'd fallen asleep, if I hadn't passed out on the couch or the chair. But maybe the thunder and rain had alarmed her, so she came down to look for me, and when she didn't find me on the couch, she went outside. She's the only one who ever calls me Donald, and often when she's mad at me. It was hard to tell whether she was mad or scared or both. And I didn't know how to respond. What was I doing? I supposed I'd taken a rest or a break, figuring that if I couldn't crawl onto the deck right then, I would be able to later, after I'd gathered my energies, or the stairs had become less slippery, or something. So I'd lain in the wet grass in the pouring rain until I was so rudely, briefly interrupted. I'll quit there.
So you don't go easy on yourself. You're putting it all out there.
No, I don't go easy on myself. I like to think that if the only person who I am embarrassing in this book is me. I am the butt of the cosmic joke in this book, and. Yeah, it was cathartic writing it. It really was. Again, I do get better. Life gets better. Everything gets better as the book progresses.
Yes, true. I want him to explain about finding a sponsor. That's one of the necessities of belonging to AA.
Yes, it is, and it's something that isn't listed in the initial AA literature or anything. It kind of developed over the course of the program. Finding a sponsor, I knew nothing about any of this. Finding a sponsor, that was the last thing in the world I was going to do. Because, like so many others who came in, you know, I had had years of therapy, if not decades. I had lied to seasoned professionals, you know, for forever. You know, what was some amateur going to help me about, you know, telling my problems to him? But over the course of being in AA, I recognized that there was some wisdom in having a guide, someone you respected, someone who had been through all this, who could provide some outside perspective, because the 12 steps require you to take an inventory of yourself, to figure out, you know, what your so-called character defects are. Mm-hmm. I thought those character defects were part of the ineffable charm, which is me. You know, I didn't recognize those as defects at all. But the program beats into you that perhaps you are not the best judge of who you are, and you might need a little help in this journey. When I first got in there, the idea was, well, you know, I was going to be like a cafeteria Catholic. I was going to do the ones that felt comfortable to me and just ignore the steps that didn't. And the ones that felt comfortable to me were the things I could do on my own. The ones that required, you know, involving another person, that was where I got, a little skittish. Ultimately, I made the big leap there. You know, by the time, and this is inside baseball because I don't expect anybody to know what these steps are, but by the time you get to step 4 and 5, you absolutely need to have found someone else who can be guiding you through parts of the program. So I did find someone else, and it became part of what to me is kind of the mysterious way. You know, they talk about the Lord working in mysterious ways, the Lord in whom I don't believe. I believe this program works in mysterious ways. I believe that there are ways that you become connected with people who you otherwise wouldn't become connected with. The person who became my sponsor was a little older than I was. He was politically very much at the opposite pole that I am. He was a devout Catholic. What we had in common is that we both had a media background. We were Irish drunks with similar senses of humor, perhaps gallows humor. And his brand of Catholicism was kind of the Thomas Merton, Richard Rohr, meditative. So we could find a common ground. And he would always just tell me, embrace the mystery. Mm-hmm. And I think embracing the mystery is a great attribute for life, no matter what your beliefs are. So it was, I'm firmly convinced that finding that sponsor, actually moving to Des Moines, you know, I think this is part of some larger plan that I didn't necessarily have for myself, but things somehow worked out for me better than I could have planned it, better than I could have anticipated. Wow. Is that the God in whom I don't believe? Is that fate? Is that coincidence? Is that whatever? You know, I don't think that we can really, plan out every aspect of our lives. I don't think that we're the best judges of what's good for us. And I also, if there is a God, I don't think that God is bigger than anything that I could imagine or envision. Mm-hmm. I let go of all this. I do the kind of things that the program suggests. Live where your hands are. Put one foot in front of the other. Do the next right thing. Live one day at a time. All of this has worked very well for me as common sense advice and kept me sober for more than 13 years.
Wow. Don, I did want to ask, you write in some detail about your family of origin and also mm-hmm. your wife and children. Did you get any pushback from any family members about divulging some of this?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it was a difficult line to walk. Some of it was expected, some of it was not expected. But I wanted all through this to be, again, scrupulously honest in telling my story, only my story. But none of us live in a vacuum.
Right.
None of us, I mean, there are other people involved, and they would have their own stories to tell, and they might tell different stories than I do.
Are there things you left out either because you knew it would upset somebody or because someone asked you to leave it out?
There are all sorts of things that I left out that I didn't consider germane to my drinking. You know,
right.
There are people who are really important in my life who are not in this book because they had nothing to do with you know, the, I mean, we at the start you talked about this book being a memoir, and it is in some ways, but it's a recovery memoir. It's not my life and the wonder that is me. I don't think anybody's really interested in reading a book about me. I tried not to invade anybody else's privacy except when it was necessary to tell my story about some sort of, you know, turning point or escalation or whatever. I'm also, you know, in my family, I'm the oldest of five. And so there's a 10-year gap between the oldest and youngest. So, you know,
same in my family.
Some of us grew up in the 50s. Some of us grew up in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah.
Some of us grew up in Chicago. Some of us grew up in Nebraska. My father died very young. My father died at the age of 49.
Oh, my gosh.
I was
okay, so, Don, I got to stop you because I'm also one of five, 10 years exactly between my older brother and my youngest brother, and our father died at age 49.
Oh, my God. See, we're the same person.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, you can consider that, you know, this is part of this big cosmic plan that we have absolutely, you know, so, that somehow brought us together here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of coincidence there. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, nobody told me that I was going to be talking to somebody this morning who had such similarities to the story that I'm telling, although you don't have a drinking
right
problem, you know. But yeah, so it's and I think one of the things we do in AA is we learn to see the connection everywhere. We learn to recognize the common humanity. And we're not all the same, we're all distinct, but we all share a lot of similar traits. And I think that's...
Absolutely.
I hope that's one of the messages of the book.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. And I did want to mention that Slippery Steps is published by Ice Cube Press, and our friend Steve Semkin is the person who did put us in touch. And yeah,
yes.
He's.
And thank you for having me. This has been a delight.
You're very
I
welcome.
Really
thank
it.
You for being with us today. And Caroline, do you have some final words for us?
Well, one of the things that they there's a lot of different quotes from the book, but this one was interesting. This is an AA prayer that they say, perhaps, please release me of the bondage of myself. I thought that was very interesting.
And the bondage of self is something that I physically feel, the palpable, you know, almost like putting your head in a vise or something, you know, like it's being squeezed. And
wow.
It's also good, you know, I mean, as a writer, I often have to get out of my own way. You know, I have to discover that clarity. I have to, you know, clear away the weeds, whatever it is. And yes, untangling yourself, releasing your, you know, release me from the bondage of self. That's you know, that's a great prayer, whether or not you believe in anybody whom you might be praying it to. Maybe, you know, maybe you're the only one who can release you from the bondage of self. I don't know. You know, it's the longer I'm in the program, the less I'm sure of a whole lot of things.
Well, thank you, Don and Caroline, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.